My guest is one who has done a lot of good in how she looks at the world, its issues, its problems, and the solutions that we should be embracing. She is Dr. Elizabeth Sartorius, and she is speaking with us now from Malcora, Spain. She is an evolutionary biologist, a philosopher, a futurist, and a former professor specializing in designs of living systems. In addition to having taught at MIT and the University of Massachusetts, she has been a contributor to the television series Nova Horizon and serves as a consultant to the UN on indigenous species and people, and has been a keynote speaker for many of the conferences devoted to humanity's future. She's also authored several very important books, including Biology Revisited and Earth Dance, Living Systems and Evolution. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary.
It was 3.5 years ago that I filmed you out in California.
Was it really?
Time
flies.
But I was, and you will be happy to know that you have become the Joseph Campbell of my new film, feature film.
Oh, what's it going to be called?
It's all about a reexamination of our medical paradigm, and it'll be out in about 6 weeks. We're trying to qualify for the Academy Awards, and I will see that you get a copy.
Fantastic.
Because at the time, I filmed you for about 3.5 hours in no small measure, because every time you gave an answer, it was so comprehensive, I had no place that I saw I could edit it. So you're all over the place in this film, and I just thought I'd share that with you. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you just 3 questions. Take your time. Be as comprehensive as you want. There's no interruptions. And the first area is, why has separating ourselves from the rest of nature gotten us into so much trouble, and how can we resolve that trouble for a better future?
Mm-hmm. Shall I go with that one?
Yes, that's our first
one. Okay. Well, that's a wonderful synchronicity that you're asking me that, because I am just reading Charles Eisenstein's book, The Ascent of Humanity. Are you familiar with it?
Yes, I am.
Okay, the entire book is devoted to this question, and I haven't gotten too far into it yet, but I'm very excited because this young man, from my perspective, he's a young man, has done a brilliant job of tracing our separation from nature all the way back to the Stone Age, with the beginnings of language and then agriculture and so on. And to me, the most fascinating thing about what he's talking about is what our money system, our current economy, has done to continue this separation from nature. And I'm reminded of my own childhood, which was just up the river from, you're in New York City, aren't you?
Yes.
Right. And I was born in Athens, New York. Only much later did I become a Greek citizen, and now I'm living in Spain, as you said, on the island of Mallorca. And I'm here, by the way, to see about re-greening an economy that was once green. That economy that I grew up in the Hudson Valley of New York State, was a true community of people, mostly European immigrants, mostly farmers. And at that time, people grew food for each other, and a shopping trip was my father taking us in his Model T Ford panel truck from farm to farm, and the grown-ups exchanged the news, and we kids played in the hay barns and all that. Everybody was feeding each other. One farm had chickens and eggs, and another farm had dairy and cows and milk and buttermilk and butter and all those things. And then another one grew fruits and honey and apple cider, and my mother grew vegetables, and we loaded those up. And everybody gifted each other with the food. It was almost no money being exchanged in this economy. And then we sewed for each other. We performed for each other. We had loads of potluck suppers and things like that. So we had a true community that was quite close to nature. There were no chemicals used, so actually all our food was organic, only that name hadn't even been applied yet because that was just how things were. It was only during World War II that chemicals began to come in. Before that, nobody had them. When they first came in, nobody could afford them, and nobody needed them because our pests were under control and our water tables were high and our plants were and animals were fertilizing the soil every year. We were close to nature. We watched nature, and we behaved like a good, healthy, what I would call mature ecosystem in the way we treated each other cooperatively. Now, today we live in a world where my grandchildren grew up and they weren't even allowed to run free alone out in nature, and everybody's scared of letting them go out into the nature that was left. Now, the Hudson Valley, by the way, fortunately, because it's the watershed for the city, got preserved quite well. And I don't know what happened to all the working people that lived in working towns that now seem to be boutique towns. But the point I want to make about our current economy is that we have now brought almost everything people used to do for each other into the monetary economy, where we no longer depend on each other, on particular others in our community, because we buy everything, and it doesn't matter who we buy from. You don't have to have any kind of relationship with them. And this is what Eisenstein does so brilliantly. He shows how, you know, two-thirds of the meals eaten in the United States today are takeout food or eaten away from home. And somebody else is cooking them. We don't even cook for each other anymore. Our child care, our nursing care, our everything that people did for each other is now for sale. And that has taken us further and further and further away from natural living systems, communities, where people were interdependent. Now, the good news is that with our monetary economy collapsing and peak oil happening at the same time and global warming kicking in with more and more climate disasters, and we haven't seen anything yet, we are going to be dependent on each other again. So far, you know, when there's an earthquake in Haiti or a flood somewhere and everybody rolls up their sleeves and helps and goes down and volunteers and behaves like a natural human community with everyone helping each other, well, I think all of us are going to be in that boat. We're all going to be doing it. You were talking just before I was listening in on some of the things you were saying about how to rebuild community with each other. And that has to be the biggest thing on our agenda right now, to rebuild local community, to find out what our resources is, what we can contribute to each other, and to remember, I'll finish this up so you can go on with other questions, but remember that if one day it's announced or you find out that your ATM machine doesn't work anymore, that there really is a financial bust, remember that there are just as many people, just as many farms, just as many machines and factories. Nothing changes in the physical world. The only thing that changes is blips on a screen, money that has no real backing, and, you know, patterns of ownership. And if everybody continued to do what they were doing the day before, we wouldn't be in trouble when this happens. But we're so dependent on this money system and psychologically so addicted to it that we can't even conceive of functioning without having that ATM machine available to us. So we're going to have to think out of the box and go back to ways of living closer to nature, and especially closer to the natures of each other, of natural community. So I'd like to kick off there and then see where you want to go from there, Gary.
Okay, well, I appreciate those insights. Thank you for that. As I am a person that lives in the country, I have my home is a ranch in Florida, and it's organic certified, one of the few certified organic farms in Florida, and it's a teaching farm.
How wonderful.
I teach people. I don't sell my produce. I give it away. People come, and an artist, for example, came last week and took a bunch to a local market and sold it for $160, and that was nice. It was just tomatoes and peppers, from what I understand. I wasn't there. But I prefer to show people, okay, we're going into a challenging time, but I'm very clear that we don't have one economy. We have multiple economies. They're very rich, have an economy, but if you have the capacity to create food, if you have a capacity to help people, give them quality shelter, if you have your own water, if you're off the grid, then you are not dependent upon the talking heads you mentioned on television telling you what you must do. Part of our problem is that the people who've been telling us what to do have not had our best interest first and foremost. They've had their own interest or theirs or their company. So I'm trying to show people each day how they can actually be self-sufficient. For example, my house is completely solared. And I started with simple things. How do you take a home in Florida and take the heat out of it so you don't have to use your air conditioner? Simple. You put an exhaust fan in, a solar exhaust fan that costs about $500 in the ceiling. Well, that drops the temperature from 170 degrees to 100 degrees, which means the downstairs part of the house is like when you were growing up and I was growing up, we had fans in the attic. And we didn't have air conditioning.
Right.
And so simple things lead to that sense of completeness. Also, why not set time aside each week to meet with friends and to socialize? And then to also see what can you do to help a friend? What can you do to help a neighbor? Then show that you're connected to these people. I think that when we lose contact with that, and in my New York apartment, you walk outside, you get in an elevator, everybody looks, you're on the same floor for 15 years, the person that's just down this hall almost never says a word, doesn't care about anything in your life, and you feel alienated and disconnected, and almost you can be lonely in a city of 15 million people because the city doesn't embrace people in the same way that people in the country will, or people who live a more, let's say, a more natural existence. Your thought on that?
Yes, exactly. And the natural thing for humans, we are social creatures. We were meant to talk to each other, not about trivia, not about the latest soap opera, not about the latest video game, but about the things that matter. Someone's loss of a loved one, somebody's child who's having a problem in school, somebody who needs extra help because they're convalescing, somebody whom you can supply with meals. All this stuff that we gave away to each other is now all farmed out, and you call up an agency and they bring in a nurse and you pay people to shop for you. It's ridiculous. We are natural creatures meant to depend on each other, to enjoy each other's company, to really, really bond. And instead we end up with trivial relationships because there's no more linkage. We don't behave like a living system of interdependence anymore. And everything is depersonalized. Your food may have come from the other side of the planet. Kids don't even know what a cow looks like when they're in the city. This taking us away from nature is something that I think we're going to be forced back into. And the sooner we start doing it before it's a critical emergency, the stronger we'll be when those emergencies come, don't you think?
I absolutely concur. I just saw an article about the 100 best cities in America to live. And I looked at it, and the top 10, I wouldn't live there because they're not sustainable. They don't have good soil, don't have water. They're in temperate areas out west and other places that are either too hot, too cold. But they were looking at it, oh, there are jobs here. Oh, they're good schools. So the criteria that we once used as where to live have to be reevaluated about where are we going to be able to survive. We've never looked at this idea of sustainability. Now, I'm in the process now. I've been looking for about 5 years, and I finally found some places, and I'll be closing on one. I have a contract on one. And someone says, why didn't you get a place upstate New York? And I said, well, simple. New York is a very corrupt state in its body politic. It doesn't make the type of choices of how to spend its money intelligently, and as a result, when it makes bad choices, it's not held accountable, so it just passes on to more taxes. And so a place I wanted to buy would have, they're not going to allow any form of what I would call sustainable homesteading, where people can come and do master a project. It might be drying a fruit out of an orchard. It might be making apple cider. It might be making jams or granolas. I see that's going to be very important, where people are living in a common area but having their own private lives, but sharing things that they choose to share and mm-hmm. enjoying nature at its best. And mm-hmm. I said, but I couldn't buy in New York in these because of two things. A, there's no homesteading act here. B, the local regulations are oppressive. And C, the taxes are prohibitive. But in northern Texas, you have none of that. You have no zoning. You have homesteading. You don't have any state income tax. And you can do whatever you want. And I happened to find a place that gives 400 million gallons of water out of springs on the property. It has 13 lakes. It's magnificently beautiful.
I thought you said you were in Florida.
I'm in Florida. My homestead is in Florida.
Yeah.
But I'm looking for a place where I can show people all over the world, all progressive people, that a model of what you can do, how to have an artist community, how to have a homesteaders food community, how to have a place where people are neither artists nor homesteaders but want a quality of life, just a rent space.
Oh, I gotta put you in touch with my friend Claude Lewins in New Zealand, who's an expat American who went down there to do this kind of thing, and he has the most wonderful, beautiful designs for that kind of living villages of all different kinds.
And everything's off the grid. I'd like to know about this person.
Yeah.
Meaning it's all solar or solar wind. The water is pure. The soil is fertile. And because of the breezes off the water and 500-year-old shade trees, old log cabins, it's like a different world, and yet it's only an hour from Dallas. So what people don't realize is the future is for those, in my opinion, who are willing to work with nature and with each other.
Yes.
And try to see the world in a positive light instead of, I believe, we're going to be seeing probably 70% of the American population suffer because they're not going to know how to change, transform. They're going to be living in urban, suburban areas. Your thoughts on that?
Oh, well, I often say, you know, I realize that not all young people want to be organic farmers, and that some of them are going to want to do technology, and that's fine, because you only have to follow two simple rules to go ahead and be really creative with technology, and the two rules are, don't put any toxins into what you're making and make them fully recyclable. If you just follow those rules, then which means we'll be using more and more natural materials. And you know, one of the wonderful things that science is showing us now is it's really looking into the nano world of nature to see the most remarkable materials that are all made of organic stuff, and there's no heat beat treat, there's no waste. You know, a spider spins 6 different kinds of spider silk and can instantly change from one to the other depending on how the wind is blowing or whether it's a structural element or a prey catching element or what, and it just on the molecular basis can turn these different ones on and off and shoot them out at an incredible rate. And when scientists started copying spider silk, they found out that it was the strongest, most resilient material in the whole world. So what did they make out of it? Bulletproof vests. Well, I think we can probably think of better uses for these incredible things we can learn from mother of pearl and rhino horn and all these amazing materials that we can work with. So the technology of the future is going to be fun. People are building houses that have skins that go dark when the sun is too bright and light, like the sunglasses, and that can photosynthesize like a leaf. You know, this planet has been living for 4 billion years on solar energy alone and only uses a small percentage of the available solar energy to create ever more diversity and evolve new species and increase the complexity of its ecosystems. And, you know, while I'm talking about that, look at our own bodies, where we have 50 trillion cells. And it's hard to grok that every one of those microscopically, invisibly small to the naked eye cells has 30,000 recycling centers in it, keeping your proteins healthy 24/7, and 1,000 banks giving out free ATP money, free, no debt. It's like stored value debit cards. You go out and spend them. When you've spent the limit, you take it back to the bank and they recharge it. And the bank's job is just to balance how much currency there is out in the economy of the cell to make it run right so that there's neither inflation nor deflation and everything keeps working. Because the money is for the purpose of running the economy, not for the purpose of making relatively few people rich and the rest of the people poor. So we got to stop playing Monopoly. It's time for people to educate themselves and look at the alternatives, look at biology, look at nature. It's had 4 billion years to work these things out. And only immature species engage in hostile competition. Mature species have learned that it's cheaper to feed your enemy than to bump them off. So this is a wonderful time in which humans are just ready to really grow up and to change these systems that were fun for a while, gave us lots of toys and technology, and now we have to figure out how to take all this individuation we've learned and weave it back into communities, making sensible things, getting closer to this beautiful planet again, and building the paradise this Earth could be, even if it's a few degrees hotter.
Discuss the stories we live by, such as the Western scientific worldview, and then alternative stories to that one.
Well, that's one of my favorite ones because I was trained in science. And, you know, religions used to give people the creation stories of who people are and how the world works and how the world started and all those things. And then when business entrepreneurs to whom scientists were useful got power more powerful together in that alliance than the older one of church and state, we develop these secular societies, and in the secular societies, it's science that gets to tell the creation story. So, and many people know that now there's this kind of war on between the scientific evolution story and the creationist story. And to me, that's a completely empty argument because it's just two obsolete theories that are butting heads like goats and have no intention of finding any resolution, and all they want to do is prove the other guy wrong. Now, the reason I say they're both obsolete is because the religions are evolving at a very fast rate into a kind of religion where God is not some father figure in a white beard or Descartes' grand engineer making the machinery of nature or things like that. But we all go through personal spiritual development, and we all find our unique ways to relate to the divine, and we see more and more how the divine expresses through nature. And then in evolution theory, that Darwinian theory that suited the capitalists so well is only half the story. It's about the competition of juvenile species and doesn't say a thing about the wonderful collaboration and cooperation of mature species. So I was taught in science that this is a non-living universe. It's running down by entropy. There's nothing we can do about it. Life is an uphill struggle of competition and eventually loses to the sweep of entropy and everything dies. Well, it's small wonder living with that kind of a story that we developed a consumer culture to console ourselves as everything went to hell in a handbasket. But that's not the only available story, and we are seeing more and more scientists now tell a story that says, no, this is a living universe. This universe begins in consciousness. Not consciousness isn't some late product of meaningless material evolution. It's the source of matter. The whole world is intelligent. The whole universe is intelligent, and we are all intelligent co-creators within it, who can make up our own stories. Now, if you look around you in the world, everything you see around you that didn't grow in nature is something that was started in a person's mind who thought up this house, this computer, this chair, this car, this whatever, or this constitution, this play, this novel, you know, everything that we produce starts with a thought, with a possibility, with a vision of what we want to create. So when we have a creation story that says it's all alive, it's all conscious, all can learn, we can create our realities, then we start saying, well, let's be careful what we think about. Let's really make plans that are going to lead to a healthier future and not just adopt any old story we hear in the latest soap opera or whatever. We are the masters of our fate. It doesn't matter if the money system collapses. It doesn't matter if we run out of oil. Those things are just going to push us into our creativity and give us a glorious chance to do things better. So what you believe in, what your story of the world is terribly, terribly important. And I say, you know, when things look really bleak, rise up above this human condition, look down on it as if it's on a stage and you're watching a drama, and don't get mad at the villain. Just say, hey, he's doing a good job being a villain. What can I learn not to do from him? And so use your energy then to say, where do I want to play? How do I want to affect the plot? Where can we go in the future? Where can my children go, my grandchildren go? What an exciting thing it is to know that we are co-creators in our own story of evolution.
Really nice insights. I would add a perspective that I see all the time, because I'm counseling people all the time. The vast majority of people that I see or interrelate with almost always take the stories from their past, use that which was traumatic, the remarkably negative story, and then every emotion, everything they do comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
So get just one quick example. There's someone
stuck.
There's a person I know, a woman I know, who as growing up had a father who was dominant and was not sexually abused, but was denied the kind of love that all young children really need and deserve. Now this person is pushy, respects no boundaries, lies constantly, and as a result ends up self-sabotaging every single thing that this person does, whether it's in business, personal relationships, and then blames the world because she mastered the art of blame. Her story, I don't care where she's at, what she's doing, she will find a way. When you don't have any boundaries, then you're living in an emotional anarchy. Then you feel this emptiness, and you try to go after what you feel will cover your emptiness, fulfill your emptiness. And then when that doesn't work, then you blame everyone else for what you feel, so you never have to take responsibility. And if you should, in some glib and offhanded manner, take any responsibility, it's to dismiss as irrelevant the damage you've done and to other people. And then that cycle, those tapes go right back off again. No matter how many opportunities you give this person, they will redo the same thing over and over and over again. Then they wonder, why don't you trust me? Why don't you make time? Well, because you have a repeating history of doing the wrong thing consistently. And the average person doesn't do what you're suggesting. You're suggesting, you just said, look at how many mistakes the bad people make. And what is it I can learn so I don't become bad like them? And that's a good lesson, but I have to ask, how many people do we know who can look at the bad that others engage in and say, I won't do that? We haven't done it in Iraq. We haven't done it in Afghanistan. We're not doing it in Pakistan. We haven't done it in Israel. We haven't done it, and we won't do it in Iran. We're not doing it with the poor in America. We're not learning any of these lessons, at least from my perspective. Your thoughts on this, please.
Yeah, well, I think you're saying it very well, Gary. If you keep doing the same thing, you're going to keep getting the same results, right?
Yes.
That's what people expect, things to change, and they don't realize how stuck they are in a rut. and how much time they spend thinking of the things that can't work, that they don't believe can happen, or criticizing others. All that negative energy is just blocks you from seeing ways to do things better and getting better results, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Now, I'm going to open our lines up for people to call in and share their points of view and ask you questions. Our number, if you'd like to talk with Dr. Elizabeth Satorius, and by the way, that she spells it S-A-H-T-O-R.
No, T-O-U.
T-O-U-R-I-S. S-A-H-T-O-U-R-I-S. And her book is Earth Dance, Living Systems and Evolution, and her website is www.sahtouris.com, satorius.com.
Correct. And there's lots of free stuff there.
Good. Now, a couple questions, and these are going to be some off the topic but related. I've heard so many times that that one of the reasons that there is no peace in Israel and the Palestinians is because the Hamas has refused to acknowledge the right of Israel to exist. And I feel that that is a very serious issue. At the same time, what we do not hear is that as official position, Israel has refused to acknowledge Palestine and the the same rights. We hear one side to justify their argument. We don't hear the other side. I see no honest effort for peace in there. I see what amounts to a continuing conflict because of the radicalization and polarization of the leaders, not the average person.
Yeah.
What do you see as the problem and the solution for Israel, the problem and the solution for Iraq and Iran? Because if we don't come up with some ideas, you know full well that the United States within the next 24 months is going to bomb at least 500 separate locations, both the nuclear facilities but all other military facilities, which means infrastructures of civilians, hoping that there'll be a revolution that'll take out the Islamic guards and the Ayatollahs. That's not going to happen. It didn't happen in Iraq. It's not going to happen there. If anything, it'll unite the country. And that you're going to have, in effect, World War III, and Israel and the United States will be the two perpetrators. I do not see that as a viable option. I would like your thoughts about how to deal with the Iranian issue, how to deal with the Israeli issue, because this is also the world we live in. Because if there's war in Iraq, we're going to end up having a price of oil go to at least $300 a barrel. We're going to have $10 a gallon gasoline. You're going to have people not going to be able to heat their homes. You're going to have people not be able to travel. There's a fly. You're going to have all sorts of complications because of this. And I don't think that we think these things out.
No, well, see, from my perspective, the problem that we have now, although the founding fathers of our own country all warned us now not to let business get more powerful than government, we sat by and let that happen. And the bankers and the businesses are dictating to the governments. And we are seeing now, after they restructured the Third World to get cheap labor and cannon fodder and stuff out of them, worse than colonialism was, they're now restructuring the First World, too, and they're getting away with it. Here in Europe, Greece is the first one that they're trying it on. Now, the banks got Greece to borrow huge amounts of money and then cooked the books so that the European Union wouldn't know how deeply Greece was getting into debt. And then suddenly they call it in, and as a condition of the bailout money, they're making Greece buy huge amounts of armaments. Now, you started with the Israeli-Palestinian situation, and it's no different from what's going on in the rest of the world in that sense that the leadership, the government, is beholden to vast, wealthy economic interests who dictate what to do. And from their point of view, the more conflict there is in the world, the more armaments they can sell, the more rebuilding materials they can sell. So they don't have any interest in making peace. They do not have interest in making peace. The amount of money that the U.S. spends in Afghanistan and before that in Iraq and all over – You know, a small fraction of that could be, rebuild that country and make it, you know, everybody middle class, let them all live well, teach them to design and build their own reasonable businesses and stuff. And all of that, you see, done from a friendly perspective of human beings close to nature helping each other would work. But so we can't sit back and let the governments make decisions anymore. And everything we've been talking about tonight, start finding out who is your community, who are you going to be interdependent with when there's a huge collapse. Start growing it from your local community up. And trust those people-to-people organizations in Israel and Palestine. Help them, give them support, encourage them, talk to each other about possibilities of peace among children, among people. And that's what will happen. We'll finally maybe get something like democracy if we start taking the responsibility and not sitting back and just griping about what the government's going to do. Because, people, it is too late. Your government has been hijacked. And, you know, if you vote for somebody else, I think you were saying earlier, we may choose in the United States between Sarah Palin and Mrs. Clinton. It doesn't matter. Whichever one of those gets into power then will be beholden to the big business interests.
Well, we saw that with Bill Clinton.
Yes, we did. And every time he tried to do something decent, they knew how to pull him down from the beginning, didn't they?
But now, isn't it interesting, recently, Bill Clinton, to his credit, and I commend him on this, acknowledged in Haiti that, no, maybe it wasn't in Haiti, maybe it was in New York, that his bill, his plan for Haiti when Aristide was in power was to use neoliberalism, free market policies, and he brought rice from Arkansas, his home state, into Haiti with subsidies, which killed the entire rice-producing self-sufficiency.
Exactly. Yes.
And he went on the record to acknowledge that didn't work.
Yep.
And
it wasn't intended to work the way any humane person would want it to.
But then he turns right around now, and you see what is called crisis capitalism in Haiti. They will build gigantic, large industrial parks. They'll hire people without the ability for unions. They will keep the cost of labor at about $1.50 per day. And so those 100, 200, 300,000 people, and that's in a country of 9.3 million, 300,000 dead, approximately 2 million are homeless. It will not help those people, but now that country is run by a committee, and the United States is the head of that committee. The World Trade, International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and are also on this committee. Bill Clinton's on the committee, but the president, right. The president of Haiti is on the committee, but has no voting power. So this is just one way that we deal with people. We exploit them. Now, give a last question for you. Take a look at Greece as the example. We saw the rioting in the streets. What we were not told was that Greece was spending $2 billion, when it didn't have it, on submarines.
Well, this is what I'm saying, Gary, that the banks are requiring Greece to buy these armaments. It is not because Greece was choosing to have all those armaments. They don't even have anything to do with them. They are forced to buy them by the banking system that's running everything. Whoops.
I see that. Now, what do you see happening in Greece? Will Greece stay a member of the European Union? Will it go back to its own independent currency? Will it default?
Well,
what do you see?
Well, I hope not. I hope that the European community will stay strong. And I hope that, you know, we're not going to have one after the other country fall to this banking system in this way any more than I like seeing what happened in the United States, where the money is just printed out of thin air, but the taxpayer is then charged for it. And that's the same thing that's being done here in Europe now, and we're going to fall together probably pretty quickly. This game cannot continue to be played, and all I can say is people, find out who your community is, have faith in each other, You know, we may have to start over practicing democracy by taking local responsibility and building it up from scratch again. We're going to, you know, have a popcorn effect in natural disasters. This oil spill in the Gulf is horrendous, but the oil companies are going to go up to Alaska and go on doing the same thing in a place where you can't even get help in when you have a spill that will affect the entire planet if this one doesn't do that already. So these big companies, the sooner they fall of their own weight, the better. In my opinion, you know, don't keep investing in that big economy. Invest in your local economy, in each other, in your human resources, your human capital.
If we would have only done one smart thing, when the crash came, let all the too bigs to fail by going under structured bankruptcy.
Would have been better.
It would have been better because then we would have gotten rid of those people who risk and let all the companies that were engaged in that kind of casino capitalism fail, but we didn't, and now look how far in debt we are.
Exactly.
I hope that we learned some lessons. Thank you very much.
I hope so, too, and now I'm going to go off, and my town is having a wonderful village fair with lots of bonding going on.
Great. All the best to you.
And all the best to all of you listening, too, Gary. It was a pleasure being with you again.
Thank you.